When Harvard's Robert Kaplan was with us last August, he took aim at the shortcomings of leaders in both the corporate and political worlds. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, the business management professor returns for a discussion on the critical areas now in need of decisive action from our leaders. We'll also examine risk. What makes a venture worth the gamble? Can starting a business in tough financial times be a smart move? And how to tell a good risk from a bad one? Plus, when it comes to the jobs crisis, Robert Kaplan says, before we ask what to do about it, we should ask why we have one. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Opening up a restaurant or starting a print magazine are considered among the biggest small business ventures with the greatest risk of failure. But what about complex financial investment firms called long-term capital management, or say, MF Global? Both of these risky ventures offered great rewards at first, followed by disaster, spawning the question, what's good risk and what's bad risk? This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is a man who knows a little bit about risk and says he hates motivational babble. Prairie Village native Robert Kaplan is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs. He's also the author of What to Ask the Person in the Mirror. Dr. Kaplan is in town for a speech on capital markets and the global economy as it relates to commercial real estate, a sector that many thought at one point presented just as many risks as the residential real estate disaster that helped cause our historic downturn. Dr. Kaplan, welcome to Central Standard.
Good. Thanks for having me here.
How do you define risk?
How do I define risk? There's lots of ways to define it, but I guess it's what happens when things go wrong.
What happens when things go wrong? Not the likelihood of things going wrong, but what happens when things go wrong?
Yeah, there's two parts. What's the probability of the event? And then what happens if the event occurs? And the reason the second part is so important is a lot of low-risk events have happened with great regularity in the last number of years, things we thought were highly unlikely. Home prices never go down. It turns out we were wrong. And so I think the world has learned that even very low probability or unlikely events that have big impacts, you need to assess.
As a former manager in an industry, investment banking, where there was high risk and high reward, where there still is high risk and high reward, how do you assess risk then and what's your approach business-wise to risk now?
Well, in the business I was in for many years, what we used to do is we would do scenarios. So we would say, what are potential events? What are scenarios that could happen? And what's the impact on us? And what we try to do is, in the lingo, those are called tail events. You know, there's a normal population distribution, and the tails are extreme things that could happen. We want to manage the tails to limit their impact. And I apply that same way of thinking to, you know, families' finances, countries' finances, or any business operation.
What were some of the tails when you were at Goldman, and how have they changed now?
Well, I'll give you an example of a tail. Now, remember, I ran all the client businesses. So for me, my tails were different than the trading people.
Right. Right.
What would be my tail? My tail would be business revenues decline 40% because the market goes way down. And I worried, have we hired too many people? Can we lower our costs? I don't want to be hiring and firing. I don't want to do that to people's lives. And so we would try to run lean, for example, to manage that tail. So in good times, we didn't have enough people. But it made it so in bad times, if revenues declined a lot, we didn't have to fire as many people or didn't have to fire people at all.
So there were different risk considerations or tails or risk matrices, if you get deep down into it, on the trading side.
On the trading side, as vice chairman, I used to be part of the firm-wide risk assessment. I'll give you an example of a tail there. Everybody knows about value at risk in big public firms. How much could you lose in a day? But what I found is the thing that kills you as a financial firm are big risks that are illiquid. So currency is very volatile, but I've never heard a firm going out of business because they lost money in currencies. They just close their losses because it's a very big liquid market. Mortgage market is another matter. Mortgages are very illiquid. And so what you find is, what you fear is a scenario where mortgage market turns down, but you can't sell it.
Right.
So what illiquidity does is things you could sell for 80 cents on the dollar because they're illiquid, like your house, you sell for 60 cents on the dollar because you're desperate. You know, if I had to sell my house, God forbid, I have no clue what I'm going to get because I'm panicked. And those are the risks that you really worry about, illiquid risk, where you have to sell something that's illiquid because you know you're going to take a huge loss.
Are those scenarios not built into these risk assessments or risk platforms?
Well, we learned at our firm you've got to. So I multiply by many multiples illiquid risks. And so even managing Harvard Endowment or managing a big pension fund, you're very sensitive. Or as an individual, I worry about things where if we made a mistake, it's not easy to fix it because it's illiquid. That's why in your own personal portfolio, be careful how much illiquid investments you have, because if you turn out to be wrong, you can't fix that in a day. It could take you years to fix that.
Has anything changed, Professor Kaplan, after the bailouts? There are critics who charge that it's business as usual on Wall Street. What's your assessment of the post-bailout culture on Wall Street?
Well, I think things have changed a lot.
In what ways?
Well, I'll tell you. I'll go down two paths on this one. First of all, the financial firms are less leveraged. Now, MF Global was a striking outlier. In fact, I was shocked when I read in the newspaper they were leveraged 35 to 1. But if you look at every other big firm, they were leveraged 5 years ago, 30, 35 to 1. They're now leveraged 10 or 12 to 1. And so they have a lot more capital, we're a lot less leverage. I'm not worried that a financial firm is going to fail because of lack of capital. They may have to raise more equity. So that's a big change. There's much more scrutiny of tail risk by regulators. The stress tests that have been so famously been performed are going to
by the FDIC and the bank.
Yeah, and the Fed and the Treasury. That's another – they're much better management. That's on the one hand. The culture of Wall Street is it's – They're realizing the monkey is on their back to prove they can add value to society, and they do feel castigated, and they realize that as unpopular as bankers might have been over the last 20 years, it's far worse now, and so they know the onus is on them to prove they can add value to society.
But everybody was culpable in that culture. You mentioned you were surprised. John Corzine was actually a colleague of yours from Goldman Sachs in that era, and then left to be with the Senate, and then came back to MF Global. Was some of that MF Global leverage culture a holdover from the period of high leverage, or was it a new aberration?
Well, I admit, and I know John, I like John, but I was stumped by what I read in the paper, what was going on there. Now, I can throw out some guesses. He left the business in the 90s and then became a senator and became a governor. And the way MF Global was run might have been the way a firm could have been run in the 90s. But you can't. It's just a ticking time bomb today. And maybe it wasn't right in the 90s either, by the way. But the world was much more forgiving and markets were much more liquid. So they did two things. They were leveraged 35 to 1 and they had concentrated bets on Europe. It was a matter of time before that was going to catch up with them.
You mentioned on your program, as we talk about the revolving door between politics and business, you mentioned John Corzine, the senator and governor in New Jersey, and then coming back to MF Global. Robert Rubin is the same thing with Treasury and Citigroup. There are other risks, political risks, that extend beyond the business arena that you mentioned. How are these risks played out?
And you're referring to other risks, meaning?
Political risk, political choices, policy risks.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's put it this way. We're in a period now, and you and I've talked about this before, where this is the end now of an era where we had 50 or 60 years where the country was more leveraged, consumers were more leveraged, businesses were leveraged, and now we're in a deleveraging period in the Western world, here and in Europe. What does that mean? One of the implications, back to political risk, is policy mistakes by a policymaker at the Fed or Treasury in the 90s, I might not even pay attention to. Today, people hang on every policy decision because when we're this highly leveraged, policy choices are magnified. Everything the European Central Bank does, Mario Draghi, is magnified. Why? Because they're so highly leveraged and there's no room for error.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is the same way, hanging on every word.
Same. And so we're going to go through this, I think, for a number of years where policymakers, everything they do is scrutinized. You know, these little congressional battles. What happened in August, the fiasco on the budget, wasn't the first time there have been fiascos or ugly situations in Congress. But the implications now when we're this highly leveraged, if they can't come to an agreement, it sends the shockwaves through the market. It could cause us to get downgraded. That is new. And it creates a much greater element and a new element of risk that honestly, in a lot of my career, we didn't worry as much about political risk. We worried about in emerging countries, you know, in dictatorships, you know, in Venezuela, we worried about it. We now have to worry about political risk in the United States and in Europe, and it's got to be a big factor in everything you do.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall, along with Robert Stephen Kaplan, a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs Group. He joins us live, and we're talking risky business, not Tom Cruise in the living room with a T-shirt, but lessons in high finance and leadership. You had high hopes for the Congressional Subcommittee on U.S. Debt Reduction. What happened, in your perspective?
I don't know. There are two or three things happened. One, there was Bowles-Simpson Commission that the president set up in 2010, which I must say, I didn't agree with everything they said, but they did a great job. And they came up with great recommendations. And I actually think for whatever tactical reasons, President Obama decided not to embrace the recommendations. People think healthcare might have been the biggest mistake of his presidency. I don't. I think backing away from that commission is the biggest mistake of his presidency. So what happened then is it set us off in 2011 in a void. We have this big deficit. The Republicans are aggressively filling that void by saying, here's how it ought to be reduced. Paul Ryan comes in. And the president, in my view, didn't have a proactive position or a clear vision about what he wanted to do. Republicans took the reins. And then we got into August, and all of a sudden, they try furiously over 2 weeks to do a deal. Not surprisingly, it failed. Then they have this subcommittee that is charged with doing more work. And the reality is neither side wants to touch it. It's going to get dealt with, I can tell you that, though. In the first quarter of 2013, the Bush tax cuts expire. A lot of these issues are coming to a head. I think 2013 is going to be quite a year. It's going to be the year of debates about entitlements, and it's going to be the year that the Bush tax cuts, for one way or the other, get dealt with once and for all. How, I don't know, but it all has to get addressed then.
Kansas City, are you in business or have you started a business? What do you consider a good risk? If you could sit down with a Harvard business management professor, what would you ask him? Call in with your questions at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email your questions in at centralstandard@kcur.org. If you also want to talk about economic policy and political risk and ask our guest Robert Kaplan about those issues, you can also call in. Once again, the number is 816-235-2888. A good deal of your focus, Professor Kaplan, these days is on managerial leadership. What kinds of risks must a good leader be willing to take?
Well, and I do think a lot about what they should take and what they should avoid. The biggest risk to avoid, I'll start with that, is isolation, where everybody knows something except me. Everybody thinks I'm making a bunch of mistakes, but I send off a vibe, I have all the answers. I don't want to hear it. And so I'm walking around feeling all smug, and everybody around me is scared to death that I don't get it. That is not uncommon for all of us. I was having breakfast with my nephew this morning, and we were talking about how Romney made this comment, I want to be able to fire service providers. And he was maybe taking a little out of context, but we were talking maybe he's a little out of touch on how that came across, but I admitted all of us in our way are out of touch. If I'm a broadcaster, I'm out of touch in certain ways. If I'm a professor at Harvard, I'm out of touch in other ways. When I was on Wall Street. And so the trick to avoid is you've got to seek out other people. You've got to ask for advice. You've got to puncture that isolation. That's one risk to avoid. What's the biggest risk that people need to take? Find conviction. Don't be afraid to think about your strengths, your weaknesses, what your passions are. And if you have conviction about something, which happens every once in a while, don't shy away from embracing it and thinking about how to act on it. That's the biggest risk I'd like to see people take.
Dr. Kaplan, David Gergen, a correspondent with U.S. News & World Report and also a pundit on CNN from time to time, says we have a deficit of leadership. We've gone through the S&L crisis, the long-term capital management crisis of the late 90s that coincided with the Asian economy's downturn, Russia's last recession, MF Global, as we just mentioned, Enron, Anderson, AIG, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. Why hasn't the publicly traded business community and political community in tandem applied any lessons from these episodes of malfeasance?
Well, and you know, I know David Gergen a little bit because he teaches at the Kennedy School, and we've been in part in meetings together. I actually don't agree
that there's a deficit of leadership.
I'll tell you what I think. It may surprise you. I actually think we've got millions of leaders in this country. This country is rich with leadership. You doing this show is exhibiting leadership. The military person serving in Afghanistan, if that person's not a leader, I don't know what is. And I know a lot of those people, they come back and are in my classes. The small business person's a leader. The person listening to this show who's the head of household is a leader. The CEO, we got lots of leaders as CEOs. What the disconnect is, and why David Gergen says that, is why don't we see it applied to solving some of the problems of the nation?
Right.
And the reality is I've come to believe – I think the culture in Washington is different than the culture in the rest of the country. This is a cultural problem. The minute I step foot in Washington, D.C. within a 10-block radius, I might as well be in another planet or another country that I don't understand. The rules are different. What's important is different. What's valued is different. And the leaders become captive to it. So – and by the way, good people who come – from the rest of the country who are leaders, they get into that ecosphere, and all of a sudden they get defanged because they can't deal with all the design of Washington and the culture of it. So I would rather see us deal with how Washington is set up and go right at that culture.
Well, you mentioned the cultural changes in leadership. How much of this has to do with the rise in CEO pay disparity to the average rank-and-file worker, or the culture of Washington and Wall Street, basically the Beltway being connected to the Jersey Turnpike by lobbyists?
Well, let's face it, whether you like it or not, and I don't like it, we voted for a lot of what we got. Here's an example. Can you remember back 10 years ago, there were these proud pictures of people with big chainsaws and big thick stacks of paper, and they were chainsawing through, and the caption in the back said, "Bust regulation." We were going to get rid of regulation. Well, we did, and we went overboard, and I would argue much of what happened in the last 10 years is we went from one extreme to another, to no regulation, literally none, in my opinion, and now we're moving back. Maybe we go too far the other way. But the reality is I don't think that our leaders have gotten worse. I really don't. I think we've got as many or more than we ever have. I think the design of some of the way we do things is outdated. If it were a company, we'd scrap it.
What are some examples of that?
Well, I'll give you
design.
An example. I'm part of something called No Labels, which is my meek attempt – with a bunch of other people in the country to change the way Congress works. So what's an example? We've come up with a number of rule changes we think should happen in Congress in 2013. And most senators and congressmen we talk to either quietly or vocally are in favor of it. We don't think Congress people should get paid unless they pass a budget. We think if the president makes a nomination for a job like this Richard Cordray, 90 days up and down. We don't think pledges should be allowed. You know, Grover Norquist pledge, no new taxes. If you want to argue against taxes, go ahead, but not because you took a pledge. And I think we need to go at the design of the way Congress works and Washington works. And that will affect regulation also. We've got a cultural problem in a very important place in our country, which, as I said earlier, has become more important because we're so leveraged, and that's Washington. How we ever got ourselves so leveraged in the last year with two tax cuts, and whether you agree with the wars or not, and two wars, will be one of the great lessons of history that we'll talk about for the next 100 years.
So what you're saying is there's leverage all around. Leverage with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the federal deficit and the leverage that we saw from derivatives on Wall Street.
We've gone hog wild on leverage. I mean, literally hog wild.
As a culture.
We really have. And we borrowed GMP from the future to do it in the past. We really have borrowed it on our children's and our grandchildren's credit cards. And the clock, it's time for that's over. And by the way, it's going to be a tougher job for every leader. Now, leaders in the future are going to get blamed for having to deal with this, but they've got to deal with this.
A question from Shane comes in, Robert Kaplan. Given the cost of business school, you are at Harvard Business School. Yeah, it is. And the flood of MBAs in the job market. Is business school a good risk? We're talking about good risk versus bad risk and macro rules, also down to micro with Shane's email question. Is business school now a risk? You're taking on
this debt? Definitely. By the way, I must admit, when I went to business school, and I know it's time value adjusted, if business school costs as much today as it did then, I'm certain I wouldn't have gone. Couldn't have afforded it, wouldn't even have considered it. So, yeah, it is a risk. And to Shane's question, there is a lot of financial aid out there, but I graduated with loans and spent years paying them off. I think for many people, business school is not necessary. If you've already found the job that you love, I don't think business school is necessary. If you have another way to get the skills you need, I'm not sure it's necessary. If, on the other hand, you're not sure, I believe it's a great investment in your future. Education, whether it's business school, other graduate school, you name it, college education is the best investment you can make, and everything I've seen demonstrate that, even though, yes, the cost of it is so high.
So this could be considered a good risk. Give us some examples of good risk and bad risk. Just some examples off the cuff.
Good risk and bad risk. Off the cuff, the ones I look for in life are what I would call the word asymmetrical.
Okay.
Meaning small risk, small opportunity for gain, big risk of loss. By the way, we take them all the time, every day. Asymmetrical means, and I don't want to scare people, when I get on an airplane, that hopefully is not an asymmetrical risk, that if things go wrong, it's a terrible risk. And if I could have driven there instead of flown, there's not much gain. But there are lots of risks I watch for every day that people take that are reckless. Crossing the street, even though the light is red, that's a stupid risk because it's asymmetrical. If I'm wrong, I'm going to get killed. And if I'm right, I might have saved 30 seconds.
So the risk of disaster outweighs the reward with these asymmetrical risks.
Yeah, my advice to anybody in your daily life, just think about that. Think before you take some risk, is the payoff worth it? And if the answer is no, then back to business school, I think it's expensive and we know that, but depending if you're the right kind of person who could learn from it, it's a huge payoff too. And so what the heck? You know, it's not a bad risk.
Robert Kaplan is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs. We're talking risk management, job growth, and the vacuum in leadership on Washington and Wall Street. Get in on the conversation. Join us 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can holler at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option. We'll be right back when we talk about commercial real estate and growth in the job market in America. And welcome back to Central Standard. As with any risk, business risk is defined by the likelihood of failure, but our recent economic doldrums suggest that many of our country's leaders in the public and private sector have either ignored risk or failed to calculate the severity of the risk. Our guest has a simple remedy. He says people who are in it for the dough rather than the passion tend to get burned out. Prairie Village native Robert Kaplan is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs and author of the book What to Ask the Person in the Mirror. Dr. Kaplan, we've recently talked about creating a fiscally responsible role for government. It is one of four critical areas you see as a need for decisive leadership. Another one is strengthening the middle class. What are your suggestions for accomplishing these big, seemingly insurmountable feats right now?
Well, and let me comment. I can't help but comment on the intro. If you're in it for the dough, then you're going to have a problem. And I just want to make sure, because a lot of people are listening to this, it's not that I don't like to make money. I understand people wanting to make money. I like to make money. I do. It's fun. But if that's your vision, if that's the end goal, I think you're going to find yourself running into a dead end or boxing yourself in a corner or making decisions that you regret. And that's all I'm saying on that. So I just thought that's worth clarifying because it's such a critical point.
Right. To your point in your book and also in news articles such as being mentioned in Bloomberg and some of the other interviews that you did, the remedy seems to be a quick infusion of capital or a bailout or something that plugs the hole of leverage and debt. That seems to be the culture. So a lot of people are focused on money.
Yeah, I agree. And listen, a lot of people coming out of school, you want to have security. It's understandable. I certainly did. I saw my father struggle at times, and we all want some amount of security. It just can't be the driving force. There has to be something more. And there was for my parents, and there has to be for all of us. Now, back to the government and what you said. Let me just mention there are two or three things this country needs. It needs a strong middle class. That's one of our competitive advantages. It needs good infrastructure. That's one of our competitive advantages.
Both of those are crumbling, by the way.
What?
Both of those are crumbling, by the way.
Right. I know. And the third thing, a huge competitive advantage in this country, has been our educational system, which is also undermining. And fourth, innovation. We're a fabulous country in terms of biotech, technology, and innovate. All four of those things are I think, been overlooked for many years in the zeal maybe for financial engineering and other things. So and they're all interrelated. Rehabilitating and helping the middle class, you got to do those other things too. So I'd like to see an integrated approach by the government that says we're going to have to cut. We are for the next number of years. But there are three or four things that make us a great nation that we're going to protect as we cut. And that's what I haven't heard a leader. When I talk about a vision and priorities, a leader needs to lay out what the vision is, what the key priorities are, and then say these other things, yeah, we're going to cut. We're going to tighten our belt in places, but we can't scrimp on education, particularly in urban schools. We've got to invest in our infrastructure. We need to help the middle class through job retraining, maybe job mobility, and other things to help make the adjustment to globalization. We need to do things that continue to foster innovation.
Are these pieces of a puzzle, pieces of a larger framework going forward? You mentioned in your book, for instance, that you should have five major priorities and let everything else go. So do you see education, innovation, and reducing debt? What are your five priorities?
Well, in this case, I'm sure I'll think of a fifth one, and I don't want to do an imitation of Rick Perry.
Right.
So I'll stick with four. No, I wasn't kidding. poor Rick Perry on that. What I would say is it's not that you let everything else go, but if I have to make a choice, If I had a choice, would I raise the retirement age, or better yet, means test Social Security, so if I'm very rich, I don't receive it, so that an inner city child can get a better education? Yes, done. I'll make that choice. Or that we can have a better infrastructure so that we can create potentially more jobs in this country? Yes, I'll make that trade. This is all about trade-offs. I'd stick with those four. Infrastructure, strong middle class, and the other two we talked about. And I would say one other thing, which is where I probably would disagree, and I'm not thrilled with the tone in Washington sometimes. The interests of the middle class and the interest in business are not opposed. They're aligned. And we've somehow gotten ourselves in the last number of years here thinking that they're somehow opposed. I think the bailouts sort of got that started. Fair enough. But in general, what's good for business is often not – just because it's good for business doesn't mean it's not good for the middle class. I think we should be celebrating business leaders. We should be rebuilding the middle class as opposed to – we need to vilify certain leaders or people who do well in favor of the middle class. That choice is a false choice.
Dr. Kaplan, Tao from Mission Hills writes, a Harvard economics professor recently published an article speculating that the Federal Reserve should consider negative interest, which would basically be a direct penalty for the average person's savings. How can an economy move forward with ideas like this coming from the world's leading school of economics, which has an indirect influence on monetary policy?
Well, I will say your friend in Mission Hills.
Tao really kicked it off.
Tao? No, let me say more. Here's the good news, Tao. A lot of people don't listen to people at Harvard, including me. And so maybe that's for what – because I think that's a terrible idea. I agree with Tao. I actually think that by keeping rates at zero, we may be doing great damage to savers, people who are retired, people who are trying to build savings. And I'm not certain, and I know why they did it, because fiscal policy, they did it sort of thinking that will help stimulate the economy while we're waiting for fiscal policy to take hold. But I'd be strongly against negative interest rates. And to Tao's point, yeah, there's lots of ideas out there. So, from smart people, by the way, who I respect. Some I agree with, some I don't. But it's really confusing.
Well, our own ex-Fed chief Honig argued for years, months and years, that the type of liquidity that this low interest rate was designed to create hasn't come to fruition.
I agree with him. And what it's done is it creates a desire to take more risk. So
bad risk or good risk?
Well, it creates an ace. I'll tell you. We talked about asymmetrical risks.
Right.
If I know I'm going to make nothing on cash, then I start thinking, oh, my God, I've got to buy risk assets. And the truth is that skews, it distorts the assessment of risk. And the fact is cash and some risk-free assets, everybody should have it. And we're penalizing people and pushing them. If you want to make a return, you better take some risk. Not a good thing.
You're going to be speaking on capital markets in about an hour and a half. Another listener sends in this question. Should capital markets be able to determine interest rates themselves, contrary to dictated interest rates created by the Fed? This, the listener suggests, might allow for competing currencies.
Well, to your listener's point, right, let me say this is what's confusing about interest rates. The Fed sets only the short
federal funds rate. Right.
That's it. Now, to your viewer's listener's point, so the market sets the other rates. Here's one weird thing the Fed's been doing, though. They are actually going and buying the treasuries. They're actually in there every week now buying treasury securities, which is artificially keeping treasury rates lower. And so a lot of savers would normally buy treasuries, but the Fed is putting, in effect, they're sitting on the rates. And I really wish they weren't doing that. But the reason they're doing it is because Ben Bernanke is a student of the Great Depression, and he's decided I need to be stimulative in any way I can, or else we've got this whole deleveraging going on, and he fears a deflationary spiral. That's why he's doing it. But it has some severe repercussions.
We're talking about public and private sector risk and how to assess these risks going forward in these economic times with our guest, Robert Stephen Kaplan, a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We got Grover in Midtown. Grover, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, I guess my question is, what's the tipping point? What's the point to which we can't recover? We can't support a middle class. We can't support infrastructure. At my age, I don't see a whole lot of growth. I don't see a whole lot of return, for at least a generation until we get some of our leverage, our debt, our whatever, out of the way. To me, it's unfathomable that we've gotten ourselves into this mess, and that we should actually start trying to figure out a way. And I'm not sure what that way is, and I don't know what the repercussions of trying to get fiscally responsible, where we aren't spending money, is going to impact. I just don't see a whole lot of future for my children at this point.
Grover brings up an interesting point. A lot of people feel of Grover's age, retirement age, or nearing retirement, that it's about a wrap. It's over as far as any potential recovery that they might see in their lifetimes. How do you address that?
I see the point, and that I actually think we've got several years in front of us. As you and I have talked separately, we've got a number of years in front of us to deal with this mess. Now, Grover said the key word, start. Here's the irony. We haven't started yet. Now, we look over at Europe and we sit here very smugly and we watch Mario Monti in Italy and say, boy, look at them. They've started at least. The UK, Cameron, it's not popular, but they've started. And
they also have a higher tax rate, and they pay into their public infrastructure a little bit better than
they also have health care.
Right.
But the point is, we got to get started. That's why I said about the Bull-Simpson Commission. That was an opportunity for Obama to be the leader in getting started. We've got to get started. And once we start, to the caller's point, we got a number of years ahead of us, but I think we'll feel a whole lot better. And I think future generations, I'm going to be a whole lot more optimistic about future generations if I feel like we're 2 years into this. Even if it's difficult, I think this country is ready to get started. They want to be stronger. They want to leave a stronger country to their children and grandchildren. Let's get started.
Sarah in KCK, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I was wondering, if what we really want is something like for Congress people not to make money until they've passed a budget, what are legal means for pursuing that end? I mean, I've never heard of a national referendum or anything, and they're not going to pass any laws that are in direct conflict with making money, which is what they want to do.
All right. So
how do you do it?
So I hate when I listen to the radio and people say, look at a website, but let me go ahead and do it anyhow. Look at a website, and it's called No Labels. Google No Labels, okay? Or Google, do the Google No Labels. And what you'll see is we've actually – here's what we're proposing. May not work, but we're trying. Congress can actually pass these reform rules, okay? And the voters can put a lot of pressure on Congress to pass these reform rules. I haven't talked to a congressman or senator yet who doesn't tell me, I hate it here right now. I'm thinking about retiring myself. It's no fun anymore. This isn't why I came to Washington. I want these rules. I want to see Congress work. So the way it would be done, congressionally, Congress could pass these rules. And it's going to take some discussion of them. And we're going to try to make that discussion visible as we head into the 2012 election.
Thank you, Sarah, for your comments. Your No Labels campaign is similar to what we saw with Warren Buffett not too long ago, where he basically put out a plan not to pay members of Congress, to cut Congress's health care, to make them essentially get in the chambers of legislation and actually do something. Is this becoming more prevalent in the business and high finance community?
I can't speak to the business and high finance community because I don't hang out with them.
You don't hang out with them
I don't
more?
Hang out with them, or they don't hang out with me as much as they used to, or vice versa. I can tell you this. We've got people from finance. We've got people from Republicans, Democrats, every walk of life who've gone in together on this. And so I'll tell you what I'm learning. We need to keep this moving forward, and we need followers. And so I think we have like 200,000 members. We need to get it to 1 million for anybody to take this seriously, and so we're going to try.
You mentioned earlier in this broadcast that there are millions of leaders out there right now, the captains of units in Afghanistan and first and second lieutenants and specialists and people in their homes.
How about you?
How do leaders emerge?
How do leaders emerge? I'll tell you, and I'm not kidding when
how
I say.
How about me?
My definition of leadership is anyone who decides what they believe and has the courage to act on it. That's a leader. Decide what you believe, which is not an easy thing to do, by the way. Half the time I don't know what I believe. I have to think about it. And number two, have the guts to say, you know what? I'm going to act this time. If you do that, you're a leader.
Isn't that something maybe, Dr. Kaplan, in the risk profile of our lives, that we're not willing to take that risk of standing out, being leaders, saying unpopular things in an era of, you know, mass blaming and finger pointing, that
sure.
A lot of people don't want to take that risk for financial reasons or for political reasons or reasons that they may be shunned.
I agree with that. And listen, all of us, including me, have to kick myself every once in a while. I have to kick myself and say, hey, what have you done recently, Rob? Are you making a difference out there? And stick your neck out occasionally. If you don't do it, who's going to do it? If you don't do it, who's going to do it? And I think I find it's habit forming. If you learn to open your mouth, and I found this in my career, I disagreed a lot. What I found is I did better. I didn't do worse. I did better. I like to promote people who will disagree with me and stand up and push back and keep me from doing something stupid or making a recommendation. And I think people try it. Don't be reckless about it. And you got to use appropriate judgment. But try it. I think it's habit forming, and I think you'll be happy with yourself, which, frankly, is the most important thing.
We got Bill in Belton. Welcome to Central Standard.
Well, Happy New Year to both
Happy
of you.
New Year.
Happy New Year.
And Dr. Kaplan, I've followed your history from at least the media and everything, and I like a lot of what you are saying. I from your description there, I guess I am a leader because my wife keeps telling me to shut up, but I don't know. I always tend to be one who says, no, did you hear the other side? Huh. But my question to you is this, and several of my customers and the gentleman I'm working for now are small business people. Now, we're talking small people like under 25 employees.
Right.
People that are out here and they do the work.
Yeah.
I mean, they're out there producing. And when I was with a bigger, larger corporation that happened to be called P&G, but I won't mention that, these people get away from production. They become glorified bookkeepers. They're CEOs, CFOs, COOs, and they're all the same money managers and manipulators. Why are business schools producing people who are moving away from the concept of what I consider capitalism, which is a production of goods and services for capital, instead of like the current leading Republican nominee who moves capital for capital for capital and doesn't
right.
really generate anything for the economy.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I agree. So you should know if you were hanging around with us at Harvard Business School, we're talking about this all the time in that we want people, I think, another way, at the point of attack. Are you making something? Are you adding value? When I talk about vision, it's about what value you're adding. And it's interesting. So we actually sit around the faculty at Harvard and say, why is it still, despite all this emphasis we have in all these classes on producing things, we have so many people going in? And I went in myself to financial services. Why? And the truth is, some of it is the jobs. Some of it's the money. And so I think you're seeing the mix change. I think one of the benefits of financial services not being as lucrative, I think you're seeing people going into other things where they are more productive, where they add more value directly. I do think there's a productive role for financial services, by the way. It just shouldn't be 25% of the economy. Maybe it should be 10 to 15%.
How can that role change, though? You mentioned financial services not being as productive in terms of tangible assets as it used to be, but with the role of derivatives that are tied to tangible assets and not really worth anything, you're essentially trading a promise. How do you change that culture?
Here's what I've seen. When I joined financial services, this is going back 30 years ago, literally, basically what we did, banks lent money to small business and, yes, some big business. In addition, we help people raise money. We help start new businesses. I feel like we helped a lot of people. The trading businesses, including derivatives, when it becomes more about trading paper and you're not actually helping a business create jobs or build their company, that's when Wall Street starts going astray. And it got too big a percentage of Wall Street. So when I say there's—
Which was too big a percentage of the total economy.
It was. And so a lot of that stuff. So I think the banker in this town that makes loans, boy, I'll tell you, if you like that, I believe you're adding a lot of value and it's a very critical job. If you've got a trading desk and you're trading derivatives, less critical. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not saying finance isn't a valuable industry, but that the point of attack is, I think, to the caller's point, I think a parler would probably agree, given a loan or helping somebody build their business or advising them, that's valuable. We've gotten away from that, and Wall Street's got to get back to it.
Speaking of loans, let's switch gears here a little bit. You're in town to speak at the Integra Annual Real Estate Conference here in downtown Kansas City about capital markets and commercial real estates, back to those old fundamentals, land, labor, and capital. It was capital markets and residential real estate that was in part putting us where we are. What are you seeing in commercial real estate as it relates to capital markets?
Well, and I'm going to have to tell the group to their great dismay today, I do not consider myself even remotely a real estate expert. Sad, I know. But I can talk about the markets and the macroeconomics, and they're going to have to interpret the impact on real estate. Here is my comment, though. When you've got 9% unemployment, it doesn't take a genius like me to say, I don't have to be a genius to say it's going to be bad for commercial real estate. There's going to be less people in buildings. If you've got a household sector that's over-leveraged, it's going to hurt retail like malls and retail space. And so real estate is very soft. The things that are doing well right now are things like rental properties have had a revival because people can't get mortgage loans to own.
Right.
Housing market is soft. Commercial real estate, depending on the city, is soft because of high unemployment. And retail real estate, although retail has had a pretty great resilience this year, you know, I think it's kind of questionable to me how strong that will be for the next number of years as we're deleveraging.
Now, given that, going all the way up the ladder, and given the softness of real estate as it relates to what you just said about commercial real estate, is there any validity to speculation that there's risk of commercial mortgage-backed securities going forward?
There's risk, but I think that bomb went off. So what you always worry about when I say about tail risk, I worry about bombs that haven't gone off yet. That bomb has gone off, and those securities are priced accordingly, meaning you're already seeing it. Now, there are some banks out there probably that have illiquid mortgage loans that haven't been properly marked, but I think that's the exception.
So you think we're starting to see a little bit of a recession, a receding of the toxic loans, particularly in commercial real estate?
I think a good percentage of it, not all of it, is reflected in valuation. And this is why banks trade at 7x earnings. And you say, wow, how could that be? It's because people fear all this toxic stuff on their books.
In commercial real estate right now, what would you consider a risky bet versus a safe bet?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I defer to an expert.
They're going to love to hear that at the conference. You know what?
Well, no. No, by the way, I better tell them I don't know because otherwise they won't. But the fact of the matter is, here's the only thing I'd say on this. The only safe bet I know, if I find a house for my family that is within my means and I can meet the mortgage payments and I love the house and I want to live here for 15 years, I would put it not quote-unquote safe. That's a good move. Okay, if you're speculating, wondering how real estate's going to be valued in a year and 2 years and 3 years, I don't get that.
Is that a bad move?
I let's put it this way. It's not a move. It's not a game I understand, and I think most people shouldn't be playing it. And the problem is many people played it for the last number of years who shouldn't have been.
And many people are still playing it to a certain degree.
They should stop. Do what – when I say figure out what you believe and then act on it, figure out what you can figure out and act on that. There's certain things that are indecipherable, and I learned in my old age, don't try.
Turning toward a broader long-term picture as we look at the trouble with the euro and the continued public debt and austerity debate here, what's it going to take leadership-wise to turn things around or at least make sure things don't get worse?
Well, I'll tell you this. In Europe, for all the criticism here of Europe, I've been amazed at the leadership over there. People here take for granted how hard it's been for Merkel and Sarkozy and Mario Monti to do the things they've done. They're doing tax increases in some countries, austerity. We haven't done anything like it here. They're actually doing it in Italy. You know, Lord, I'm impressed. Also, people overlooked one very significant thing that was done in December. The European Central Bank agreed to provide three-year loans to European banks. Everybody overlooked it here. They shouldn't. That is going to provide enormous liquidity to the banking system, and that will help.
Barbara in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard. We only got a little bit of time here, but what's your thoughts?
Well, good morning, and this follows up very, very well on what he just said, and back to a previous point also. I'm a Depression kid. I was born in 1927, so I lived through the 30s. Went to Kansas State in the 40s, had a very, very conservative economic professor. But this was one of his kind of principles that he picked up from the 30s, and that is this: never underestimate the importance of beginning. And given the political situation, the economic situation, the stagnant area that we're in right now, I keep thinking of that old principle: never underestimate the importance of beginning. We've got to begin somewhere.
Thank you, Barbara. What do you think about that as we close?
That's fabulous advice. It would be as if I needed to lose 100 pounds. The hardest pounds will be the first five.
So okay. We're at the beginning.
And once I'm rolling, you know, I'm chugging along. But to your caller's point, we haven't started yet. And I think that's – by the way, that's fabulous advice, I think, that I wish people would take. Let's at least get started. It's the biggest step.
A native of Prairie Village, Robert Stephen Kaplan, is a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and former vice chair of Goldman Sachs. He joins us live. We were talking about business risks, leadership, global economy, and – a new beginning all over again. Thank you, Barbara. Mr. Kaplan speaking noon at the Integra Annual Real Estate Conference in downtown Kansas City about capital markets and commercial real estate. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you, Jabalani. Good to talk to you.
Tune in tomorrow as we remember loved ones lost in 2011 and look at the changing nature of the obituary and how we remember our dearly departed. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi. Up to Date is next, examining food nutrition labels and how to measure good eating starting at the grocery shelf. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.